HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 75, recorded live Tuesday, July 24th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with John Lamb at the OSCON conference about the Iron Ruby pre-alpha 1 release.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm here at the O'Reilly Open Source Conference, OSCON, with John Lamb. And did you announce today that you're doing... Today is Monday, by the way.
Yeah, I announced at 2 a.m. today on Monday.
Anyway, what did you announce?
So we shipped our first source distribution of the Iron Ruby implementation from Microsoft.
So you shipped Iron Ruby. This means you shipped your first drop. And I saw that it was labeled pre-alpha 1.
Yeah.
And I downloaded it off of your website.
Uh-huh.
But what's the plan for where that's going to be hosted?
So down the road, right, what we want to do is we want this thing to be hosted up on RubyForge, right, which is the community site for Ruby software development. And right now we had to just ship it out as a zip file on my blog simply because that was the quickest, easiest, lowest friction way to get the code out there to people.
And the plan is to get it up on RubyForge, and I understand that you're going to be taking contributions.
Yep, absolutely. So that's probably the biggest announcement there is that, you know, not only are we going to be up on RubyForge by the end of August, but we are going to be accepting community contributions back into a subset of the Iron Ruby language project, right? So specifically that subset is in the libraries. What we're doing initially is we're going to reserve the compiler pieces, right? So we're going to keep that. We're not going to accept contributions back into the compiler pieces for a very, very good reason. And that reason is today, Iron Ruby is built on top of another piece of software that my team creates, which is called the Dynamic Language Runtime. And so the DLR is not, in Microsoftian terms, fully baked, right? So in essence, we don't have public interfaces for this thing yet, and code is still kind of migrating back and forth between what is in the DLR and what is in the compilers. So until we can firm up those interfaces, right, and until we can get to essentially a 1.0 quality release with publicly defined APIs for the DLR, we can't accept contributions back because potentially external code could wind up in Microsoft terms, tainting the DLR, which will ship with the CLR and all that kind of stuff. So we simply can't have that happen. But once we get these public interfaces inside of the DLR itself, then we will fully open up the Iron Ruby compiler to all community contributions.
Now, I spent the better part of today, this is Monday, and I think this podcast is being listened to on Friday, with my intern, with one of my high school interns, and we took the Iron Ruby stuff and we built up, using Scott Guthrie's Hello World example, a WPF example that we wrote it in Notepad. And it calls a C-sharp client that is a REST front end, pulls out some C-sharp types, like an array of accounts, and we go and pull some information down from a financial services website. And we put that account balances information into a WPF app. So we had C-sharp in there from a library that we wrote. We had some WPF and .NET 3.0 all talking together. And as I said on my blog post, that it was very, very, you know, pre-alpha, and I was accepting that. But what I thought was really interesting was the kinds of stuff that we bumped into, stuff that, you know, just wasn't done yet, gave me a lot of insight into the kind of work that you guys need to do. For example, I got back an array of accounts. I put it in a variable called A, and then I said A square bracket 0 to pull an account out. And I got what?
You probably got nothing. You probably got a missing method exception. Right,
exactly. I got a missing method exception square bracket.
Yep. So the important thing, and actually what's interesting is, you know, now that I think about what happened to you there, you probably could have walked up to that class, right, that represented the .NET type and added the square bracket method yourself.
And that's interesting. I had that thought myself because I ended up just calling get value
sure.
because get value was on system.array. And I said, well, I wonder if I could use the method missing features to go in and build this thing up and make it look the way I wanted it to look.
We fully support method missing in the set of bits that we ship today. In the future, we're going to do a bunch of auto magic stuff, right? So a lot of these things I've already done in a former life when I built Ruby CLR. So in Ruby CLR, when I detect that you're marshaling a type from the CLR that implements the enumerable interface, I do all the right things. I provide in each implementation for you. I auto mix in the enumerable module, as well, or the enumerable mix in. So then you can use all the standard Ruby idioms for iterating over, you know, some collection.
Yeah, and that was the thing I thought was really interesting was that it didn't feel very Ruby-esque because each time I wanted to use a Ruby-ism, it wasn't there yet. And I started looking at the source.
Uh-huh.
And that was what was so much fun was to figure out, oh, I see where John and team are going to have to get in there and hook this up.
Yep.
We were doing, I brought in a single, a system.single. I typed it as a float, came in as a system.single. I wanted to do a two-string. Looks like it wasn't there.
Yep.
So then I ended up switching it to a double and two string was there.
Yep.
And then I went and looked at some of the built-ins that you had in the Ruby stuff. You've got like fixNum.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about that? I saw that fixNum was an extension of an integer. Is that a derivation?
Yeah. So no, it's not an extension, right? It is a type substitution. So in essence, what we're doing is we're saying that, okay, anytime where you see an int, right, instead, please treat this as the Ruby type fixNum. Right. So, you know, all of our method dispatch code essentially where you can essentially dispatch against an integer and it goes, oh, okay, I know exactly where we need to route this method is to the fixNum type. So what you'll see if you look in the implementation, there's a file called initializer.generated.cs, which is a giant like 100K file right now in the sources. If you look inside there, that's essentially the file where, we mark, these methods, which are effectively extension methods. Especially using attributes. When you're looking through the source code, I'm sure you saw lots and lots of attributes sitting on top of methods. So what we do is we've got a little tool that will go through the methods, read the metadata, right? The attributes, and then we will code gen out, a bunch of goop. Right, to essentially say, okay, well, you know, this is the name of the class, it has this set of methods on it, right, and it really represents this .NET type in that case.
So forgive my ignorance if I use the wrong words, but is type substitution the equivalent of what I would have thought of as marshaling? Are we moving from one world to another?
No, well, no, because an integer is an integer, right? So, so essentially what we're saying is that any time the Ruby implementation, because remember, the Ruby implementation runs on top of the CLR, so
right.
It is using things like ints and
right.
doubles.
So we're not moving in and out of universes like we did with com-interop.
No, and quite unlike, you know, a Ruby CLR, where, yeah, I had to marshal types across a boundary, right? Because across, you know, there are two completely different worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
One is a C-based interpreter, and the other thing is the CLR, right? So everything is just in the CLR. We're essentially giving you a different view over the types that you currently mm-hmm. have today in the CLR.
So if I knew up a string in the Ruby.NET, in the Iron Ruby world,
right?
Okay, and I passed that string into my C# library.
Uh huh.
What happened there? I mean, the string's still sitting somewhere on the heap.
So one thing to really remember is that what's different between Ruby and most other implementations is that the Ruby strings are mutable strings, right? CLR strings are immutable strings. So we have to convert when we cross the quote-unquote boundary, right?
Because of the way strings work.
Exactly. And if you take a closer look at the way we've implemented the extension methods and the various types in our libraries, what I generally do is we wind up having an overload of the method takes a regular CLR string and then also another overload that takes a mutable string. So the design of the library is such that we want to stay as strongly typed as possible wherever we can. And in cases where, you know, the type being or the parameter type being passed in, right, we can't determine that,
mm-hmm.
right, then we'll accept object and we'll do conversions and stuff, right? So there's all sorts of patterns in the Ruby library, for example, where you can pass in random objects, right? And what the library will do is attempt to call toInt, or actually attempt to see whether or not there's a toInt method implemented on that object. If it finds that, then it does a different thing with it, right? It essentially treats it as an integer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So for the purpose of some of the viewers may not necessarily know the difference or remember the difference between a mutable string and an immutable string. So if you could just speak on that for just a moment as a reminder.
Sure. So when you create a CLR string, right, once it's being created, you cannot change the contents of the string. Every single API that you would call on a string that you would imagine is changing the string. It doesn't actually change the string. It actually creates a new string with the modification inside of that string.
So your implementation of a mutable string, if I remember correctly from looking at the source code, it had a string builder in there.
Yep, exactly. So today, and that's an implementation detail, right? So today, so you'll also notice that unlike trying to do that type substitution thing that I did, mm-hmm. With fixed num and integer, instead we wrapped mm-hmm. a string builder in a mutable string. The reason why is that eventually string builder is going to go away in our implementation.
I see.
The reason why is that Ruby itself treats strings as byte arrays, not char arrays, right? So effectively a string builder is a dynamic char array.
Oh, I see.
And, so for that reason and for compatibility with Ruby, you know, somewhere down the road, we're going to swap out the implementation of string builder and swap in, a mutable byte array.
And as you said, that's certainly an implementation detail.
Yep.
I just found it to be a particularly interesting one.
Yep.
So in that case, strings are really the special case, as it seems with almost all languages, right? We keep saying strings are strings, but ultimately every language has its different perspective on how a string should
Absolutely.
Operate.
Yep.
Now, I noticed that a number of times I had to call two string, two underscore string and two underscore s. Are those the same methods?
No. Two under str and two under s, right?
Okay.
Are the two different methods. So what two under str is it's another one of these Ruby signal methods effectively. So what Ruby does or what the Ruby libraries do is they walk up to that object and invokes a respond to, right, on that. It says respond to str, yes or no. And if so, it treats that thing as a string and invokes other methods. So effectively it treats it as a duck typed string.
Say something about duck typing for our listeners.
Sure. So duck typing, you know, so here's that old saying, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it probably is a duck. So you're essentially saying, well, if an object responds to the methods that I would expect a string to respond to, then it must be a string. Right. So it's about as simple as that.
Hmm.
So back to the idea about using two under str, it's one of these marker things, right? Two under int is another one of these marker things inside of the Ruby libraries. So we just simply go off and check to see if it's a string, and if so, then we treat it as a string from that point onwards.
So in this process, there are a number of times where I passed an object in and then had to call two string on the object. But then once I actually ended up having to call you, and you had me call a secret method called two CLR string.
Right.
And is that something that I'm not going to have to think about in the future?
Yeah.
Why did I have to do that?
Oh, well, right now, that was just the most obvious way for us to deal with what happens when we need to convert a mutable string into a CLR string is to essentially force you to explicitly do it. Down the road, we will, you know, do some magic to take care of that for you.
Sure. And, even though there were a couple of things like that I bumped into, it was funny. We were looking at the code and it was a mess of comments and whatnot. We ended up stripping all the comments out and it was pretty simple. I mean, really there was nothing to it. We spent more time putting together what the WPF XAML was going to look like.
Sure.
Doing it by code, building the object model ourselves.
Yep.
Now, how do you anticipate this is going to be used? I assume it'll be a first among equals kind of a situation where I can do anything if I feel like doing WPF in Ruby or ASP.NET?
You shouldn't have any inherent limitations in terms of the kinds of, you know, libraries that you should be able to consume from our implementation. You know, I think there's a number of really interesting scenarios that you can look at. You know, the Silverlight one being one of the obvious ones because, you know, right now, today, nobody else really has the ability to run Ruby in the browser potentially across an extremely large deployed base of, you know, browsers support Silverlight. So, you know, and also cross-platform between Mac and Windows. So, you know, that's a really interesting reach opportunity for us. And WPFE style programming, right? I'm not sure what the actual name of it. Internally, we call it SPF, but I'm sure there's some other kind of name for what.
So it was SPF, Silverlight Presentation Foundation?
I think so.
Right.
But I think its acronym status has been revoked, so I don't think it actually means anything
it's
anymore.
It's a three-letter acronym.
Yeah, so I still call those guys the SPF guys.
I see.
And, so that programming model is, you know, I think in need of having some additional support, right, for building applications. Because if you look at the Silverlight stuff, it's a very, you know, low-level API, essentially, for doing drawing and presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So given that, what we would really like to be able to do is go off and build a library that makes it much easier, much more approachable, right, for people to go off and do that stuff. And I think that Ruby would just be a wonderful language for using to experiment with building out, you know, such a framework.
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, I don't work for Microsoft yet. All right, I'm going to go to work for Microsoft September.
Oh, and congratulations
on
the new position.
Thank you very much. September 3rd. So until then, I'm sure I can get myself into a lot more trouble, although I plan on getting into plenty of trouble once I get there. I always thought it would be a really interesting scenario to have the Rails programmers build some kind of a Silverlight support gem such that the relationship between Ruby on the server side and Ruby on the client side would become something maybe unique to that environment, that somehow
sure.
they would come up with ways to serialize objects in and out, perhaps via JSON, such that it would invent a new kind of deployment, a new kind of programming, such that the browser and the big fat Pentium 4 or Core 2 that's not doing any work today would actually start doing some really serious heavy lifting, and it would almost add like a new tier to classic three-tier architecture.
Yeah, and I think that would be a really interesting place for people to explore with some of the options, right? Because certainly, instead of using RGS to go off and generate JavaScript that goes off and runs on the client, right, you can just emit some Ruby code and that can go off and run on the client as well. And I think that having a language that makes it easier for you to build modular software like Ruby on the client, it's going to really do a lot and spur a lot of innovation, I think, in the browser.
Now, Iron Ruby is adding to the dynamic language, the list of dynamic languages that are supported. We had Python, we're going to have JavaScript, we're also going to have VBX, Dynamic Visual Basic.
Yep, some to-be-named product that is
sure.
the Visual Basic
So
syntax.
That's at least four dynamic languages.
Yep.
I know that you guys had a language lab, and they had the guys that do languages like Boo,
uh-huh.
and I think someone was talking about doing a Squeak implementation.
So there was Boo, there's some guys that do Cold Fusion there.
Oh, wow.
There's, of course, a Peter Fisk, who on the outside is building the Smalltalk implementation as well that runs
hot.
Inside the browser.
Vista Smalltalk?
Vista Smalltalk,
oh,
yeah.
That's awesome.
And other people, right? So I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities again for people to especially once there's more code.
Sure.
Because DLR still isn't fully baked. And so once we have some more code, more examples, more programming languages, and some documentation and that kind of stuff, right? I think it's going to make it a lot easier for people to make some progress. Although Peter Fisk, with the current state of this stuff, we just dropped a pile of source code on him and he's been making fantastic progress.
So do you anticipate it'll be people like that who will push the new, the new updates? And who are going to contribute the most source code is going to be language builders?
Yeah. I think that, there's several places, right? It's the classic, you got to scratch an itch kind of thing, right, in open source. So if there's something that's bothering you right now, I think that, filling that gap by building some libraries or contributing to libraries and stuff, right? Like, you don't need to be a compiler geek in order to go off and build some libraries, right, and to port some existing libraries over, right? So those are the kinds of things that I think are going to be opportunities for all sorts of people to contribute, not just compiler geeks.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to me today. I know that you're in between sessions right now, and we're sitting in the hallway here.
Sure.
And thanks a lot. And I encourage the listeners to go and check this out, start poking around. It is it's early, but it's a lot of fun to see this kind of development going on, particularly around dynamic languages. In my last show, the interns were talking about how they said, dynamic languages are just easier. It's just more pleasant to program in.
Sure.
It's very fun to see the almost the arm wrestling that's going on as C# continues to evolve into a more dynamic language, as VB kind of reinvents itself or reasserts itself as a dynamic language, to see these other languages come in.
Yeah.
It's almost like the promise of .NET when it first came out was going to be common language. Now, 2007, that's actually happening.
Yeah, and I think that's a really exciting time, to be working certainly in the CLR team right now.
Cool. Thanks a lot. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you next week.